self-isolation. It may be required due to illness. It may be required due to specific illness, such as COVID-19. In any one of those scenarios, however, the student would remain part of their assigned classroom. And the reason being is that we want students to have that experience within their classroom where they form their relationships, where teacher-student relationship has been formed, and not have students have to move out into the remote school and then back in again. Again, it's far more disruptive, not meeting with our guiding principles around minimizing disruption. So they would remain with their class as assigned. So I'll send the first part of the question over to Superintendent Stefanian around different types of symptoms.
Thank you for the question. And through the chair, I'm going to just preamble with what I'm sharing with you is what is current as of today and the conversations that we've been having around public health. So we know that when it comes to look at the layering of mitigation strategies, one of the strategies that is important is that we have what is described as a very low threshold for determining whether or not a student comes out of a classroom, is in a private space, and we ask a parent to come and pick them up. So as the trustee indicated, we are entering into cold and flu season, and we know that when we look at the symptoms of COVID, whether it is some of the more common symptoms or some of the less common symptoms, it certainly can present as cold or flu. We are not asking our staff to be medical professionals. They will have information around the symptoms of COVID, and if a student is demonstrating or a student communicates to the educator in the classroom that they are feeling unwell and it is with a symptom of COVID, whether it's one of the more common or the lesser known, that would activate the process in which the student would go to the office, be situated in the what you'll see often documented as the isolation space or the private space with the supervision, and a parent will be called and asked to pick up the child. At that point, we will provide the parent with some direct information and guidance, which will indicate that they need to reach out to either their family doctor or directly to public health through the number we provide, indicating that their child has been sent home from school with a COVID symptom. We also have an accountability on our part to ensure that that information is shared with public health. And also the Ministry of Education will be gathering that information from schools on a daily basis. So there is a reporting piece that will be built into that as well. What we have seen with respect to testing, we know that the timeline it takes to receive results has certainly varied throughout the time that we have been testing in Hamilton. But we are hearing now of cases in which we have individuals who have a symptom of COVID who are receiving test results back in less than 24 hours. So certainly if that young person would be tested, they would be at home until they receive the results of their test. If their test comes back as positive, then certainly they would continue their isolation for the 14 days and would require clearance to return to school. If, however, the test came back as negative, they would remain home until 24 hours past the time when the symptoms passed, and then they would return to school. So I hope that answers the trustee questions, but we know that from a mitigation perspective, one of our layers that's important to have is the very low threshold for symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that answer. I just have two more questions, and then I'm done. I'll pass it on. With regards to the screening process, aside from the attestation that has to be completed for every student prior to the start of the school year, I'm looking for clarification on the part around students will undergo self-screening each day before going to school. I'm getting the impression that that would be done at home, but that it's more or less self-reporting, and if someone's feeling unwell, they just don't come to school. do we have any plans for actually doing any screenings at the school on a daily basis at the start of the school day, for example? And how do we manage, I guess, complacency with that or compliance?
Sorry, Associate Director, I couldn't unmute. Associate Director.
Thank you. And through the chair, I will begin. So to answer the first part of your question, yes, in fact, it is a self-monitoring. That is the reason why it's an attestation that binds the parents, guardian, caregiver, acknowledging that they've read, they've understood, and they will comply by these requirements, and that is that each and every day you will do the screening for each child prior to them attending school, and if they take the school bus prior to them going to the school bus stop. And so that's the first part. The second part will be that if there is a time where a child at school, a student at school, is feeling unwell and they notify someone that they're feeling unwell, or if an adult notices that a student may be feeling unwell, there are steps then that will be taken, including having a dedicated isolation room in each one of our schools for any student and or staff member who might be feeling ill, and protocols associated with the cleaning of that isolation room. And then in terms of compliance, like any one of our policies that require to be followed, that would be the responsibility at the school level, of the school principal, to ensure that there is compliance with this process. I think the director might also have an update today from our teleconference with the minister, so I'll hand it over to the director, and then if Superintendent Stefanian has anything else to add, we'll pass it over to her.
Thanks, Peter, and thanks, Trustee, for that question. This question did come up with the minister today, who also had Dr. Hopkins and Dr. Kim from Ontario Public Health on the phone call. And the question was very similar from chairs around things such as the self-assessment, such as masks. And what the key doctors from public health have said is what's working. Yes, there's compliance. Yes, there's surveillance. But the most important thing to change behavior is going to be around adults modeling it. And so there's going to be significant training required for staff on the first PA day around these protocols. We also know that the first few weeks of school, we're going to have to constantly be reviewing. And what public health said is around campaigns. The importance of campaigns is going to be huge from local public health and from the province around these new behaviors, especially as we start school. So we're going to have to campaign and educate parents and be front and center with us all the time. So our communication tactics are going to be important, and the daily reminders with our staff and with our students and parents are going to be key. And they have said that those type of communication campaigns is what public health has said has been successful in the past, and you need to stay on top of it because it is requiring some new behaviors to be put in place.
Trustee?
I appreciate the answers there. My last question is, and I'm not sure if staff will be able to answer it, but did staff ever get a reason from the Ministry of Education on why they did not mandate masks for kindergarten to grade 3?
Associate Director.
I'm just going to ask the director, as he's had constant communication with other directors and with the ministry.
So thank you for that question. And I think Sharon had highlighted this, but I'll remind people again, through conversations with epidemiologists and SickKids, one of the main reasons was we know that all children can contract it, but as the emerging data is coming in, that older children will contract and transmit COVID-19 more so than younger children will, and that was one of the reasons they administered that, that ruling of four and up. And the second thing, you know, we were told would be, could there be potentially more risks for the younger children who could be constantly touching the mask, struggling with keeping the mask on, and touching the mask and surfaces. Those were sort of two reasons that were given to us.
No, thank you. That answers all my questions. Back to you, Madam Chair.
Thanks so much, Trustee Galindo. Moving along to the list to Trustee Miller.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. So I also have several questions. I'll try to keep them direct. I'll start with just around the information we've been provided by tonight about sort of exactly the public education campaigns, the reaching out to families via this parent portal, to walk them through what September is going to look like, what a daily check-in, you know, health check-in for students is going to look like. Could I get some clarity as to whether or not the parent portal will be, I can tell it's likely going to be the bulk of where we disseminate our information for our communities. But I brought this up at the last special board meeting. I'm concerned that making that the bulk of our focus for information delivery is going to leave a lot of families, quite frankly, in the dark. I would really love to see even a targeted mail out or direct connection. You know, if we can't do a full, you know, brochure to specific families who might not be connecting on our social media or on our tech-friendly medium. You know, our special needs families, our children who aren't going to be able to interpret all of this information in the same way as, you know, a neurotypical child would. So can I get some clarity just on, you know, what are we looking at? Are we going to be calling families that we know have ESL concerns and walking them through these steps, special needs families, or even just families who don't necessarily engage with our parent portal because they don't necessarily always have access to internet or don't have the literacy to use our app as fluently as some of our other families?
Great question. And I know Trustee Danko had the same question. She had texted it to me when she couldn't get back on the line. So to Associate Director Sovereign, from an equity standpoint, how are we engaging families that aren't able to access the parent portal for a variety of reasons, ESL, accessibility, income, and so forth? Thank you.
Thank you, and through the chair. So perhaps I'll just begin by saying that the parent portal at this time is just a mechanism that will allow us to gather the information around the attestation and the information around the pre-registration for the voluntary remote learning. The reason that our IIT division and our communications department have recommended the parent portal is that it is connected into our student information system. So there are privacy and security reasons why we would utilize the parent portal to complete the attestation and the pre-registration process. How we communicate to our families continues to be multifaceted. So to be clear, we're not going to be communicating through the parent portal. we'll be communicating to direct families to utilize a parent portal, and we'll use all sorts of approaches to do that, and right down to direct phone calls. We will have the instructions and the attestation and the pre-registration translated into our 10 most spoken languages in our communities. We will have dedicated technical support, and also others that will be able to answer questions around that someone might have about the remote learning, or someone might have about the screening process and not the technical side of it. So we're preparing for that in terms
That's
of supporting all families. And so it's really two-pronged. It's use the parent portal to get the information from families in as direct a way as possible. And we've learned through our privacy officer that one of the best ways to ensure accurate information is to put as much of the information inputting into the hands of those who have the information about themselves or about their child. And so instead of gathering information on a sheet of paper and then having somebody to input it, we know that there are errors made in the transmission of that information. So our teams have worked really hard to try and find a solution which will work more seamlessly in getting that information into our system, because we need to have very accurate information when it comes to the screening attestation. We need to have very accurate information if a family is choosing remote learning or not. And so I'll ask Sean McKillop, as our communications manager, if he has anything else to add in terms of how we will communicate about these aspects of the parent portal.
Hi, thank you. Through the chair, we have an aggressive communication campaign that's actually starting tomorrow in terms of starting to build the awareness for the parent portal. That will happen through this week. And then once the parent portal launches on Monday, we will be sending an email to all families, and using the process that we have taken similar to the report card process. And with lessons learned from that that implementation, we will be improving on that. And we will be emailing that out. We are, as Director Sovereign said, we will be translating the information, and we're going to be looking to partners such as our Swiss workers and other partners to reach our families, because we do know that it will be challenging over the summer, but we will be working aggressively to reach all of our families, and then we will certainly be evaluating how we are doing during the week and beyond. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that clarification. I'll move to my next question. I'm wondering if, now that we know secondary is going to be, you know, partially direct instruction in person and then partially online with a fair bit of remote learning, are we setting up at each sort of at the school site kind of like a mental health check-in or a support group for classrooms that's not tied specifically to their homeroom? Are students going to be able to navigate whether or not they're or is there going to be someone that they can communicate if they're feeling overwhelmed, if they're feeling disengaged, if they're feeling like they're just not getting it? Or is that something that they would connect with first their homeroom teacher, so to speak, or their cohort teacher, and then move from there? I'm just wondering if we can kind of maybe preempt some support for our teenagers particularly.
Associate Director.
Thank you. I'm sure the chair. I'll begin and then ask Superintendent Stefanian, who will wear her other hat around mental health and well-being supports that are provided. But So indeed, we will be providing supports both in our elementary and our secondary school to all of our students in a multitude of ways, including, as we've indicated in some of our previous reports. In the first report, we provided quite an extensive list of mental health and well-being supports. And in the last report, we also talked about the 30 lessons in the first 30 days, and that will be delivered in both secondary and in elementary schools in an age-appropriate way. A number of posters, signage will be available throughout schools and how students can access help. But I'll ask Sharon if she can elaborate.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The Associate Director has done a great job highlighting a number of the approaches that we are looking at for when we return to school. Staff will, well, administrators in late August, as well as staff during the staff meeting at the PA days in September, will have the opportunity to engage in some learning specifically around what the trustee has identified connected to student well-being and student mental health. We have focused on a lesson per day for the first 30 days, really with that focus on doing everything from the physical well-being to social-emotional well-being, spiritual well-being in the broadest sense of the term, and connections and relationships. So those lessons will be happening in kindergarten through to grade 12. We've really tried to take an approach of no door being the wrong door for a student to go through. We want students to reach out to whomever they feel most comfortable with in a school if they are not feeling right, or if they're feeling anxious, or they're feeling unsure. So we do have a number of groups for both students and parents that have already started this summer and that are continuing into the time just directly before school entry, specifically to target and to support anxiety in terms of returning to school. And as I mentioned, that's both for our students as well as some groups for parents. We will have, of course, social workers who are positioned and working in our schools in September, and they are there also available to provide direct support. But we recognize that it is important for our educators to also have an understanding of how our students may be feeling and how to respond in the moment. It certainly aligns with our work that we began in the previous school year around validation and, of course, emotion coaching, and that work will continue again into the fall. As the Associate Director mentioned, we also are looking at, I'm going to borrow a word that was used previously, around campaign. Part of our poster campaign includes a series of posters under the umbrella of We Help, which, again, are have been provided through School Mental Health Ontario, again, including helpful tips. So while they will be posted around the school, also available for our educators to use directly in the classroom with students, talking about, you know, general well-being and what are some of the things that we need to be doing to take care of ourselves and to be taking care of others during this time. So we are looking at a number of what we would call sort of level tier one strategies for all of our students, and then depending upon student needs, we do have more targeted supports that we can provide through our staffing resources we have available, and of course ongoing collaboration with our community in terms of what support looks like if a young person needs support that is beyond what we're able to provide at the school level. The other piece that I'll mention in it, and we did speak to it a little bit earlier in the report, is we have had a couple of meetings with McMaster Children's Hospital in response to looking at the documents that they were co-authoring that came out through SickKids, to talk about what some of the supports are that they can provide and how we can collaborate together in terms of supporting children within our community around the return to school. So those are very early conversations, but we're both very excited around the potential of how we can wrap supports around our children and families at this time.
Thank you so much. That's fantastic. I appreciate that.
Moving along, if I could ask, I believe I heard this correctly, but if I'm wrong, if I could have the clarification, is it indeed that we have not been told exactly from the ministry how our costs associated with PPE expenses will be reimbursed? I want to just double check that I heard that correctly.
I'll direct us to, I believe, Stacey, Associate Director Zucker. Thank you, and through the chair. That is correct. Right now, we do not know, one, how much things cost that we're purchasing through the ministry, although we know that it's cheaper than if we could purchase it ourselves, which is what we base our cost estimates on. And two, we're unsure of how much reimbursement we will be receiving. That's still to be determined. So I think the ministry is still working out what their costs are and possibly what their funding is and then what they can support.
Okay, thank you so much. I think as just a general comment, that makes me very uncomfortable, both from just a, fiscal responsibility in terms of setting up and figuring out exactly what our expenses will be, but also just sitting at this table, it would be very helpful if we had that information from the ministry and if our staff was able to access that information in a timely manner. So I'm very concerned about that just as a responsibility and also as a general planning point of discussion. But I'll move along regardless. In terms, moving over to the tech question, I know it was highlighted that any child who currently has a device, who was issued a device back in the spring during the original closure, who is now going to be in person in our school, will have to essentially relinquish that device. That's a point of concern for me because, one, we identified if a student has been given that, it was due to a need for either internet access or device access for a variety of reasons. So I'm very concerned that if that child potentially has an issue where they now have to, for whatever reason, has to move in back into distance learning, how do we account for, changes in need and numbers in terms of our tech? I don't believe that I saw any extra funding for tech support from the ministry. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but are we going to be keeping track of who hands in a device in terms of a list in the event that we are back in distance learning at any point during the year or in the event that that child has an unforeseen renewed need for that device? How are we going to be managing the devices that we purchased back in the spring or the ones that are right now in our under our control technically? So I'm wondering, like, that to me just seems logistically like a lot of items to potentially have to follow up on. If I could get some clarity from staff on just how we're going to be managing unforeseen
mm-hmm.
or already foreseen tech needs.
We'll turn to Associate Director Sovereign, and if this needs to go to Stacey, please redirect. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm through the chair. So I will begin and then ask Stacey if there's anything else to add. But in terms of those students who will be attending in person, they were provided with a device during the school closure when a need was identified, and I want to again acknowledge the work that was done by Superintendents Denany and McPherson, who really led that work in terms of gathering in a really short period of time a needs assessment and establishing a process by which we could deploy those devices. And through the diligent work of our IIT division, we know where each device is, who has the device, and when the device is returned. So we're quite confident, although Trustee Miller is correct in terms of some of the logistics. They're substantial, but we're confident that we have a process that will allow us to both retrieve those that are coming back and, if needed, deploy if we were to, let's say, move into an adaptive mode in elementary or a fully remote mode again in elementary. In terms of some of the one-off needs, those have always been managed, I will say, very well at a school level, at a system level, but we do have some additional resources that we did acquire during the closure period that we will have access to, and I'll ask Stacey to comment on, but I'll close my comments with this, is that we're extremely fortunate through the work of the board over the last number of years with our 21st century learning strategy to have devices that we are able to provision to all of our secondary school students and on so many devices that are available in our classrooms in elementary. As a result of that, it certainly advantaged our students during both the closure period, and we feel as we go forward into the reopening and those who will be engaging in the remote learning. So we're very pleased with that and feel that we're quite fortunate in terms of the number of devices that we have. But I'll ask Stacey to comment just around some of the additional devices that we were able to procure and would have available to us if we needed to distribute some more.
Thank you, Peter, and through the chair. As Peter mentioned, we did at the beginning of this purchase additional iPads, and we were also able to borrow some laptops, which we've been given an extension on borrowing, and we've provisioned some as well. So as far as it goes, as Peter said, we will be tracking. We know who has the devices right now. We will know who's returned them so that we will be able to, if we had to get them out again, track them. And we do have some that are available that we purchased internet-enabled, but then they turn into a regular iPad that we have that we are able to distribute out to the schools, which we weren't expecting to have. So I think we will be in good shape to be able to manage both if we were going back to an adaptive model and had to get the devices out to elementary students again and to take care of those one-off situations.
Thank you so much for those clarifications. I appreciate that. That does sound very good. just a few more questions, and then I'll give the floor to somebody else. But I know that we highlighted that caretakers will be really kind of ramping up cleaning of, you know, the high traffic surfaces, the washrooms and idea areas like that, but I'm wondering if there is room at all for sort of intermittent classroom wipe downs. Specifically, I had a few conversations with staff, professionals in our classrooms who are very concerned, particularly at the lower levels, you know, like full day kindergarten, just that their areas in terms of they themselves providing the very, very hands-on instruction they do throughout the day with very young children, their concern was that often they have their own bathrooms, so those areas become a high-traffic area. But is there any room in terms of our planning to see if caretakers could sort of
somewhat sporadically do classroom cleanup as well throughout the day.
Associate director or Ruger?
Thank you. We can take that away. It is currently not part of what the caretakers are doing, but there are additional program cleaning needs that we are reviewing as well, both with the caretakers and with the educators and the students, and what our expectations will be. So we can take that away when we're finalizing the protocol.
Thank you so much. And then I know that it was mentioned in the report that staff, so our professionals in the classroom would have a chance to engage with staff now, especially now that we've got more details as to what September is going to, or what back in the classroom is going to look like. Specifically, it was mentioned that there would be engagement between employee groups through ad hoc committees, and I'm wondering if that's the only area for educators, for DECEs, for EAs, for various workers to communicate their concerns around maybe some of the details now that we have more clear understanding of exactly what our plans are going to look like and what the day-to-day is going to look like. I don't know if I just missed if there are any other avenues for our staff to communicate their concerns specifically around the details that we'll be laying out. Even a thought exchange, I don't know if that's a feasible possibility for communicating with staff, because I know I've spoken to many educators and folks in the classroom who have some very real day-to-day concerns, who are dying to be back in their classroom, but are quite honestly quite scared of managing the details of all of the sanitation that's going to be required, all the regulations that are going to be required, and then also being, you know, in their regular role and doing their best work for what they're skilled for. So I'm wondering, you know, how we're going to be capturing, you know, the concerns off the ground as our staff needs to communicate them to us.
Associate Director.
Thank you, I'm sure the chair. So as we've indicated in the report, communicating with our leaders, staff, families, you know, remains a really high priority in a number of different ways that we know that we need to continue to reach out and provide those opportunities for listening. So I'll begin just by providing a little bit of context around what we're planning this week already, and then I'll ask Superintendent Nunn from a Human Resource Services perspective in terms of some of the supports that his team are putting in place. But in terms of our leaders in our schools and across our system, and I want to thank Superintendent Romano for leading this work, pulling together a session tomorrow where we're going to bring together as many of our system leaders who are available for a virtual session to help guide them through much of what we've had in these reports, where we are currently in terms of the planning, questions they themselves might have or concerns, and then as well the anticipated potential questions that the staff that they lead may have and ways in which they can support and have those questions addressed. So I'll turn it over to Superintendent Nunn to provide any further information from Human Resource Services.
Thank you, and through the chair, we currently, in addition to members of Executive Council working closely with our union presidents on various ad hoc committees, we are in Human Resources meeting every 2 weeks with our union presidents and in preparation for September and conversations around the safe return to work for all staff. In addition, the members of the Central Joint Health and Safety Committee, they have been meeting informally through a voluntary information session every 2 weeks as well. And it's an opportunity for different employee groups to provide their feedback, ask questions in regards to the various protocols as members of the occupational health and safety team, along with Superintendent Stefanian, work on the various protocols. As we continue in the weeks going forward, we will continue to work very closely with our unions, union presence, and continue those structures up until the start of the new school year.
And if I could add to the chair to Maria's question, Maria, you raised an important question about staff reaching out. As I know, many of us have received specific emails from staff with high anxiety. As we told people, there's no previous playbook we're drawing from. This is unprecedented, and we're doing the best we can, and we'll have more to communicate after tonight's board meeting. However, there will also be the importance of the three PA days prior to students returning. We were intentional with the school year calendar that the trustees approved, is that we wanted all staff to have three PA days to come in before, because we know that they need to be comfortable in transitioning back into the physical environment first before students do. So we know a lot of their questions and their concerns are going to have to be addressed not only up to that point, but in those 3 days will be vital. The ministry is also setting an expectation that the first PA day will be completely committed to safety and COVID-19 return. That'll be the entire day. So I think that will also provide an opportunity for staff then to ask specific questions that are specific to their site as well. Because we know there's general questions, but then there's local questions depending on the grade they teach or specific students that they're want to meet their needs but might have questions or concerns. I just want to highlight that those three PA days prior to students returning will also be key.
Okay, thank you so much. That's very helpful. Thank you, Superintendent Nunn, as well. It's good to know that they have many avenues to connect, and site-specific troubleshooting, I think, is also going to make a huge difference for, obviously, our staff at specific schools. I have two more questions, and then I will be done. Specifically, actually, they are Trustee Danko's questions that she sent me to get back on. So access to schools will be limited, but the ministry says that clubs can continue or should continue. But can we get some clarification just on whether or not that means any clubs run by parents, whether or not parent-run clubs will still be allowed under those guidelines?
Associate Director.
Thank you, and through the chair, to Trustee Miller's question in reference to the guides, we have been looking at the guides and where it is safe to do so. The guidelines do point to providing opportunities for extracurricular and clubs. At the same time, the guidelines are quite firm around highly restricted and even prohibiting access to non-staff and non-students from that school. So that is something we're looking at really carefully, connecting with colleagues in other boards as well to get a better understanding. But certainly to begin the school year at this time, we're not looking at having extracurricular activities. Again, that is just at this time to begin the school year, focusing in on the enhanced safety measures, establishing routines, And then we will look at any of the other extracurriculars.
Last.
And once we've done that, then we will explore options if they seem to be available for having non-staff from that particular school be in attendance. So I think I described this earlier in the evening, that this is a very complex puzzle with often different pieces, some of them that we haven't seen before. The complexity here involves not only students remaining in their particular cohort, whether we're talking about elementary or secondary. So that's one of the additional challenges that's posed by any type of extracurricular. The second is the restrictions around non-staff members, limiting that number. The third is the number of contacts that any student cohort might have with an adult. And then in addition, all of the other requirements around screening and masking. So thank you for the question, and we'll have an update later on in terms of extracurriculars.
Thank you so much.
Sorry, Trustee Maria Felix-Miller, we can't hear you.
Hello?
Trustee?
Can you hear me now? Hello?
Yes, we can. Yes, thank you.
Oh, that's bizarre. I was not actually on mute.
I think you're just kind of cutting out. I'm not sure if anyone else is having this, but I'm not hearing their question.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
So are we still doing full rotary for elementary? And is there any way to minimize it? Just I know there are questions around increased risk for staff and for potential spread.
Associate Director Sovereign.
Thank you, and through the chair, as we've indicated in the updates in this report and in the previous report, that cohort students, whether adaptive or conventional in elementary, would remain with their cohort so that they stay in their class. If there are other staff members, so another teacher, let's say a French teacher, that teacher will come to the class to instruct that particular cohort rather than having that cohort move to a different class.
Okay, thank you so much. That's everything from me. I appreciate all of the information and the clarifications from staff. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving along to, Trustee Mulholland?
Yes, through the chair. Peter, sincere appreciation to you, to Stacy, to Sharon, and, so all the staff did a great job working together. I know they will continue to work together in order to find solutions to this very, very complex problem. So well done. No questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Trustee Pagan Miller.
Okay, I'm really very concerned about the idea of 29 children in kindergarten. Is this a fixed number? Like, what's the plan around that?
Associate Director, kindergarten planning, please.
Thank you, and through the chair. So at this time, there are a number of pieces that, as it indicated in section 11 of the report for next steps that we do require. And first is between the 17th and the 21st of this month, parents indicating if they will be choosing remote learning or in-person learning.
Okay.
And that will have an impact in terms of any adjustments that we might make in schools for kindergarten classes. The second piece is that in terms of staffing for our kindergarten classes, we are still required to adhere to our collective agreements and our class size caps and averages. And the third piece is that I think the director alluded to this earlier. Should we be directed into an adaptive mode where there are 15 students maximum in a classroom, they would be attending on alternate days. And so currently, most of our schools are set up with an adequate number of kindergarten spaces based on the current student-teacher ratio, including a DECE for, you know, classes with more than 15 students. And should we find ourselves in a place where we're moving to a much reduced number of kindergarten students, we would also require all of the additional space if they would were to attend every day.
So, in other words, where's the additional space going to come from, though?
Associate Director.
Thank you. And through the chair, I will pass this over to Associate Director Zukertz. I know her and her team have been working on looking at some of our space challenges in the board.
Joined.
Thank you. And through the chair, we have been looking at what kind of excess spaces we have across the board. And between classes that are in existing schools that aren't being used and classrooms in schools that we have closed or will be closing that are not sold yet, we have probably around 300 extra spaces. That being said, obviously there would be significant capital work that may be required in order to have those spaces available. And then also, as Associate Director Sovereign indicated earlier, there are places like gymnasiums where you could possibly set up classes if you had to. That would take away the gymnasium program space, which wasn't necessarily recommended by the ministry. So if we were to decrease class sizes to the 15 or 20 that we're looking at, we would probably need about 500 additional classrooms. And so we would have to look to classes in existing spaces. We'd have to look at our schools that we've closed, and then we'd have to look at using other spaces differently.
Is somebody not on mute? Because I'm having trouble hearing. Okay.
There we go. Thank you. Trustee Pagan-Miller, do you have further questions?
Well, no. I mean, I'm not sure that we've really got the right answer yet, and I still remain confused and a little. Are we basically saying that a lot of the parents of the kindergarten children will be keeping their kids home unless we resolve these needs, these space issues? Is that basically what's going to happen?
So, Director Figueredo, are you able to provide some clarity over kindergarten and space, please? Thank you.
Yeah, so through the chair. So thank you, Carol, for the question. I think the key point to remember is we're going to need to know next week in terms of what choices parents will be making once, now that they know what our model will be. two, I think it's important that when we look at our kindergarten classes, that they are our largest square foot areas compared to other classrooms for the majority of them. I think they're about 1,200 square feet. So when full-day kindergarten rolled out, one of the requirements was to have, if we were going to have 29, 30 kids in ECE, that we needed larger spaces. However, and then part three will have to be, even in those spaces, we're going to have to look how staff have configured those learning environments, because many times those learning environments, as you know, in a kindergarten class were configured to have, you know, purposeful play and collaborative learning and play. We'll have to be very purposeful in how we look at furniture placement in those rooms. I've heard from some kindergarten teachers that that is not ideal and that it would contradict some of the pedagogical paths they have for kindergarten, and we acknowledge that, but the safety aspect will have to be first as one of our guiding principles. But I just wanted Trustee Miller to know that we'll need to see the data first, but also recognize that they are one of our largest classrooms because when they were purposely built over the years.
And parents, I know from my emails that I get that a lot of the parents of young children are very concerned. So, I mean, I know we don't have all the answers, and we won't have all the answers until we start to, and we won't ever have all the answers, but at least we might have more answers once we start seeing how all of this is going to work out. So I'll leave it at that. I just wanted to know if you had any response to the idea of what we're going to do about kindergarten. Because, I mean, little ones are, I believe they're quite vulnerable, so we want to make sure they're safe. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. And so I'll continue along. Trustee Tut. Do we have Trustee Tut with us?
Hi, just a quick question because, I mean, I think all the oxygen's been taken out of the room already with all the questions.
Not at all. You asked exactly what you want to ask, Mr. Trustee Tut.
I think all the substantive questions have been asked, and I'm sure staff is tired, too, at this point. But I'll just ask through you, Madam Chair, the Associate Director, what is the plan for our students in the Gateway program? Like, how will this kind of unfold and impact them? Thank you.
Great question. Associate Director Sovereign.
Thank you very much. And through the chair, I really appreciate the question because we haven't forgotten about those students who are not in a traditional classroom or a traditional school. And so our planning continues for our students who are in our safe schools programs, our alternative education programs. I'll leave my comments there and ask Superintendent Stefanian, who has responsibility for our safe schools and our equity portfolio, as you know, to provide a bit more of an update around that particular program.
So thank you, and through the chair, we've had a preliminary conversation with public health around programs. Well, specifically, we did have a conversation around the Gateway program, which, as trustees know, is our long-term suspension and our expulsion program, and whether or not there would be any special considerations that we would need to take with respect to the length of time that students are in that program. And our initial conversation really was looking at, and this was a conversation, I would say, probably about 5 or 6 weeks ago. So it was certainly at a time when PPE for staff and for students looked differently from what we have talked about this evening. And our conversations at that time, really, there was nothing that would have suggested that we need to make any alterations in what Gateway looks like and how Gateway functions. However, as the associate director said, we certainly know that's part of a broader conversation when we need to look at all of our alternative education programs, and it is on our list of things to revisit with public health now that we have more information from the ministry.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer, Superintendent. The one other question that I have is with regards to the online learning and the instructions. I'm hearing quite a bit from parents in my ward with regards to certain challenges and the actual quality, the delivery of the actual curriculum through the online way. And so I'm just wondering, will there be a follow-up or a monitoring by staff at some point, almost kind of like, I hate to use as a quality check, but just a check-in to make sure that it's unfolding the way it should be.
So, through the chair, if I could go first before Peter answers as well.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Trustee Tutt, through code conversations and recent conversations with the ministry has clearly identified what has been the experience of some parents during the March to June distance learning was not ideal for many. The ministry has indicated to us that that there will be a policy program memorandum, a PPM, that's forthcoming, we're told, by the end of this week, around providing clear parameters around what's expected of synchronous learning. And when they define that, they're really defining for parents who make the choice of the remote learning and not sending their kids back to school. And as Peter has indicated earlier in the report, hence why we have shifted in our model around reorganizing and staffing once we collect the data, because the ministry has been clear that they expect a robust programming for students whose parents choose to have them in the physical classroom for 5 hours of instruction a day, or for parents who choose to have them in the remote options, as Peter identified. We're creating an elementary virtual school. The expectation is 5 hours of instruction daily. That's timetabled and scheduled, and then capitalizing on our secondary e-learning model. I just wanted to clarify that. Peter might have more to add, because we've heard that concern the province has as well, and we're expecting this policy program memorandum to be coming by the end of the week to provide clear direction for board staff on that expectation. But in terms of your piece, the other piece around the monitoring and sort of quality control, I'll pass to Peter around our approach with that.
Thanks, Manny. Through the chair, the only piece I will add is that by establishing a remote learning school for elementary, we have assigned Superintendent Torrens to begin or to oversee pulling together what will be necessary to establish this remote learning school, not knowing right now how many of each grade, how many students we are going to have, but anticipating based on that 10 to 15%, we have a fairly good starting point. With that, we will also have school leadership that will be assigned and dedicated to the remote learning school for precisely the reasons that you've indicated, Trustee Tutt, that staff will need to be supported and guided in terms of this undertaking, and we'll use the existing structures of principals and vice principals and other support staff and led by one of our superintendents to be able to provide this programming in this particular way. In the report, we have highlighted a number of these supports that the program division and specialized services are providing, and particularly geared towards supporting staff as they work within the remote learning area. So I hope that helps.
That does. Thank you for that answer. That's helpful. And kind of my last question, it's not a question. I guess my kind of concluding comment is I just want to echo, I know earlier it was said that there's probably no funding for this, but if there could be, if the ministry was list,